Good evening. My name is Mike Malloy. Thank you for joining us. I do appreciate it. I think our Cuba guy is going to be here tonight. Peter Werby. Is he going to make it tonight? You sure? When? Next hour? Okay. We're going to talk to Peter Werby, the famous Detroit radical leftist talk show host and disc jockey and traveler to Cuba. He just returned from down there, and we're going to chat with him for a while and see what it's all about. We have a story corner tonight that is very, 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 very scary. We'll get to that later. We're going to try to get to one of Kay Petrini's report cards. What else we got here? All kinds of stuff. Sarah Palin. Is she Karl Rove, Sarah Palin. Oh, my God. The apocalypse is here for sure. Oh, you want to have some fun? Get a pen or something to write with. I'm going to give you a secret number and a passcode so that tomorrow at 5 p.m. Eastern time, you can have some fun with the Republican National Committee. All right? So have something to write with. Our good friend on the road, that's Kate, who travels all over the country doing very interesting things. She writes, Mike, if the subject comes up tonight about health care, I may fall into a deep coma brought on by rage. Got home last night from a six-hour trip to Buena Vista, Virginia. RAM, that's the rural medical, this free clinic, had never been there. So there were hundreds of people who needed health care lined up. We were short of doctors, so we only treated about 620 people. It is so sad up there. Unemployment is awful. It's hard to watch people cry with gratitude because they were able to get five teeth extracted or because they got a pair of glasses or the women who hadn't had a pap smear for 20 years. Have a good show tonight. I'll be here as long as I can stay awake. Kate, who's this week in East Tennessee, she travels around and she worked on the Mississippi Gulf Coast, working with people down there who had everything just ripped away from them. We met her here in Atlanta. When was that? A year or so ago? Right, Kathy? About a year ago. I gave a speech at an atheist convention, and Kate happened to be passing through the area. I always call her Kate in the desert because she spends a lot of time in the desert. She stopped in and wound up taking care of Molly while we did the convention. Good people. Kate in the desert. Now it's Kate in East Tennessee. Sarah Palin is comparing herself to God. I don't know what to call her anymore. The former governor of Alaska was at a Tea Party convention last month when she was caught using those scribbles on her hands at the same time she was criticizing Obama for using a teleprompter. That incident became known as the teleprompter gaffe. Well, this week she was at some kind of a convention. I think it was in Canada. I don't know why you people don't run her out of your country. Jesus Christ. She was in Canada addressing a bunch of conservatives in Canada. Well, she's there for the money. Nobody has told her that people in Canada, apparently, she doesn't know they can't vote for president of the United States. But she was up there giving this address, and she again defended her use of the hand notes from last month. You'd think she would just let this alone, right? By literally comparing herself to God, Palin cited Isaiah 49, verse 16, which states, this is God talking, quote, "See, I have engraved you on the palms of my hands. Your walls are ever before me." End quote. God. I don't quite get that, but anyway, she then went on to explain that if it was good enough for God to write on his hands, it must be good enough for her as well. Now, Isaiah 49:16, one would think was meant as a figurative and not a literal reference, although in Sarah Palin's case, she believes in demons and angels and gods and snakes and, you know, just all kinds of creepy, crawly creatures that are battling here on Earth for the soul of humankind or something. But as literal and as stupid as this woman really is, if her God is, after all, God, wouldn't he be omniscient, therefore wouldn't need to write on his palm to know someone's name? I mean, I'm taking this way too seriously. And is it egotistical? Is it toxically narcissistic or egotistical for Palin to compare herself to God in any manner? Now, imagine what would happen. Here you go. Take a deep breath. You ready? Imagine how the right-wing media, which is 99% of everything, would wet its pants, would poop in its pants, would go insane if Barack Obama made even the slightest reference to himself vis-a-vis God. But Sarah Palin gets a pass because I'm not sure why. I think I know why, and it sounds very sexist, but I don't think it's me talking. I think it's the truth talking. The truth works its way through me in instances like this. I think it's because she's hot. She's very hot. Republican and right-wingers and conservative, I'm talking about men and not a few women, would probably like to just get naked with Sarah and play cards. And therefore, she gets a pass on everything. You think? All right, you got your pencil ready. There is a memo here from Republican National Co-Chairman Jan Larimer and Republican National Committee Political Director Gentry Collins. It's for the first Republican National Committee Women's Program Conference Call of 2010. It's tomorrow at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Now you can dial in. Here's the number, 888-324-6991. 888-324-6991. And your passcode is RNC Women. You'll be asked for the passcode, RNC Women. The dial in number is 888-324-6991. And when you dial that number tomorrow at 5 o'clock Eastern Time, you'll be asked for the passcode, which is RNC Women. Now, this conference call is to discuss prominent topics confronting the Republican Party, how to get involved, and how to help the Republican National Committee win elections. Now, I don't want any Democrats calling that number. Just you Republican ladies who listen to the program. This is just a public service. I would never ask Democratic women or progressive women or atheist women or lesbian women or blue-haired women or women with freckles, you know, or pregnant women or unpregnant women to call that number. You have to be a Republican woman. The number, again, for all you Republican women, 888-324-6991. 6991, and the passcode is RNC Women. That's at 5 o'clock Eastern Time tomorrow.
C-SPAN so you don't have to. It's more Mike Malone.
Past the hour. Did you get all that information, the conference call tomorrow for Republican women? This is only for Republican women. You all just call in and join the conversation. It's 888-324-6991, and your passcode is RNC Women. Okay? Because I'm sure you, and that's at 5 o'clock Eastern Time. There is a, there's an effort here. Kat Mary in Memphis is include me in on this. I had no idea. They already have over 1 million signatures on this. Here's what it says. Most Americans never use the socialized services of the fire department. It is time to open the fire department up to private industry. We have the best fire departments in the world, the United States, but that doesn't mean that anyone, even non-U.S. citizens, should be able to dial up and have fires put out. There are private companies like Halliburton who could step in tomorrow and take over every fire department in America and charge the consumer directly. Join 1 million strong against our socialist fire department and stop big government interfering in fires now. That sounds like a good idea to me. Isn't that the way it used to be in the gangs in New York? Wasn't that part of the subplot, the competing fire departments, private fire departments? Yeah, we need to get back to, we need to get government out of fire departments. I'm thinking we should do that like maybe tomorrow. In Florida, the Florida Republican Party, they have, they're trying to get some legislation passed. You see, Florida, like a lot of states, offers huge tax incentives to movie production companies so that these big budget companies will or films will be made locally, right? So come down here, we'll cut you a break, we'll do this, we'll do that. However, the Florida Republican Party and some state representative named Stephen Precourt like the money coming in from the big companies, they just want to make sure that no productions with gay characters get the tax break. So in that light, they have introduced an idea into Florida legislature. Under their plan, movies and TV shows with gay characters could be ineligible for a so-called family-friendly tax credit in Florida. This is a little notice provision they've tucked into a $75 million incentive package that Republican House leaders hope will attract film and entertainment jobs to the state. Now, this bill would prohibit productions with what they call non-traditional family values from receiving a so-called family-friendly tax credit. No, it doesn't define what non-traditional family values are. But State Representative Stephen Precourt, the guy who sponsors, he's Republican for from Orlando, said, it's hard to explain, but, quote, think of it as like Mayberry, referring to the Andy Griffith Show. He says, quote, "That's when I grew up, in the 60s. That's what life was like. I want Florida to be known for making those kinds of movies. Disney movies for kids and all that stuff. Like it used to be, you know?" End quote. These son of a bitches are insane. You do understand that, don't you, gentle listener? Every Republican office holder in America is just absolutely wacko. The entertainment industry. "We're going to fix those goddamn heathen sodomites. No tax break for you. You're making a movie about queers?" "No, sir, it's not about queers. We have a couple of gay cast members and the plot." "No tax break for you." "But this is about, it's about biblical times." "What?" "Yeah, it's based on the idea that even 2,000 years ago, there were some gay folk wandering around the Middle East wearing long robes and sandals and following this guy around who claimed to be the son of God." "What are you saying?" We just want to come down here and make the movie because there are parts of Florida that are very reminiscent of the Middle East 2,000 years ago, like downtown Tampa. And, of course, Tom DeLay has weighed in on the Jim Bunning idea that only lazy sons of bitches draw unemployment, people who don't want to work. Tom DeLay was on CNN's State of the Union the other on Sunday, and he said that, quote, people, he said, quote, "Nothing would have happened if the Democrats had just paid for the benefits. People would have gotten their unemployment compensation. I think Bunning was brave in standing up there and taking it on himself." DeLay said, "You know, there's an argument made that these extensions, the unemployment benefits, keep people from going and finding jobs. In fact, there are some studies that have been done that show people stay on unemployment compensation and they don't look for a job until 2 or 3 weeks before the benefits are going to run out." Jesus, God. "Stolen from Japan. Collected from around the world. I catch you if they can. Lies, 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 yeah. Lies, 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 yeah. All right. Shout it out. Shout it out. Every year,
yourself with the truth. It's more Mike Malloy.
It's 25 before the hour. You know, the idea of ending socialized firefighters and privatizing it. Just think, they could be Christian fundamentalist firefighting organizations, and if you're queer and your house catches on fire, they would just let it burn. They would just say, well, it's, you know, the will of God. Of course, every house fire, I guess, could be considered by certain fundamentalists to be the will of God, right? Oh, my goodness. Well, what else? It's ironic that the same week that the Washington, D.C. Catholic Charities has opted to end coverage for spouses, Catholic Charities, no more health insurance for spouses. This is in response to the fact that the D.C. City Council has legalized same-sex marriages, right? Well, the irony comes from what we mentioned last week. The Vatican finds itself answering for a gay scandal taking place in the Vatican. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Well, I, if I were a gay man, I could not resist all those robes and mitres and jewelry and, huh? What? Yeah, the incense and the tall hats and that kind of wave that the Pope does that Anyway, as you may know by now, a police investigation into corruption at the Vatican has taken, shall we say, a twist with the discovery of an organized network of male prostitutes. Oh, no. Inside the Vatican. So far, a senior aide to the Pope and a Vatican chorister. Both have been removed from their posts over allegations of involvement in this homosexual prostitution ring. The allegations were made public when Italian newspapers, published transcripts of phone calls recorded by the police. Police had been conducting an unrelated corruption investigation. Are the police in Italy allowed to investigate corruption in the Catholic Church? Yo, cops, polizai, or whatever you're called in Italy, come over here, man. We have more scandals with the Catholic Church than you can shake a stick at, or a mitre or something. Anyway, unrelated corruption investigation. All of a sudden, they started recording these phone calls. And one of the tapes recorded Angelo Balducci, a gentleman of His Holiness. That's the title. That would be like a lady-in-waiting, I guess, if the Pope were a queen. What am I saying? The Pope is not a queen. He's a Nazi. Well, he was when he was in Hitler Youth, but that's a different story. Anyway, there it is, a gentleman of His Holiness, Angelo Balducci, negotiating with a pimp. The pimp just happened to be a 29-year-old Vatican chorister. I guess that's a singer, right? And the conversation was about men that Balducci wanted brought to him for sexual purposes. Balducci held a high position within the Vatican and carried the coffin of John Paul II. It was the 22nd at his 2005 funeral. The second, I guess. Anyway, he has now lost his position as a gentleman of the holiness. The tape conversations include Balducci describing precise physical details of the men he desired. Yeah, just like heterosexuals. Well, I want one with, large breasts, and she has to have a very small waist, and, oh, boy, what else do I want? Dark hair. Same thing, right? Balducci was a member of one of the world's most exclusive fraternities, it says here, the Gentlemen of His Holiness, or Papal Gentlemen, ceremonial ushers of the papal household. There's no telling how extensive the prostitution ring is within the Vatican, or what, if any, knowledge Pope Benedict XVI had of the activities taking place within his household. But the scandal is yet another indication, is it not, of this monumental hypocrisy that is the Catholic Church. If you're Catholic, I'm sorry. I don't make this stuff up. You know, if you want to be Catholic, be Catholic. But it would just seem to me that the world's Catholics would demand an end to the hypocrisy. You know, the constant screaming by princes of the church and the church hierarchy that there is something to be condemned about gay people, or that gay people are not supposed to get married or adopt children or have babies, or you know, and just the irony, not to mention the hypocrisy, is just so thick. It just drips from this this religious font of nonsense. Oh, don't these people ever... I mean, do they never look in a mirror and say, well, you know, maybe we should stop this, since so many of us are gay anyway. Why don't we just all come out at the same time and stop persecuting your brothers and sisters? Be Christ-like. Stop persecuting your brothers and sisters. Oh, never mind. Karl Rove was on the Today Show this morning. Did you see this? His reputation as a thug, just a filthy, disgusting, vomit-eating political campaigner, he says is undeserved. Oh, not me. No, not me. Tricks attributed to him were either media distortions or the work of others. That's what he told Matt Lauer during an interview. You want to hear some of this? Let's hear some. It starts out with Matt Lauer.
The charges or the allegations or the constant comments you hear about Karl Rove, that he was the guy behind the whisper campaigns.
In South Carolina.
Right. That he was the guy with the push-pull question about John McCain.
Right.
And suggesting, is it possible, how would you feel about John McCain during the 2000 primaries if he were by some chance to have fathered an illegitimate black child? You say you had nothing to do with that.
Nothing to do with it. In fact, you know, I write about this in detail in the book. This is the kind of thing the media love, these kind of allegations. But for people in practical politics, I got to tell you, I was seized with fear when this rumor began to circulate through South Carolina, not very widely. It was sent out by a professor at Bob Jones University, a fellow named Hand. I thought John McCain would seize it for what it was, which was an enormous opportunity to give an insight into who he and his wife are. Because they adopted... Cindy McCain adopted a child from an orphanage in Bangladesh, who is their daughter.
Really?
And the story of this is an incredible tale of love and compassion. But rather than doing that, John McCain said, I'm a victim.
Here's what Roy Fletcher, McCain's deputy campaign manager, said of the South Carolina smear. Quote, this whole thing, it was orchestrated by Rove. Cindy McCain, of that same incident. Remember, we've already set it up, the smear involved possibly that this was an illegitimate black child.
That it emanated from an email sent by a Bob Jones University professor to the people on his email list, which may have been 100 people.
She clearly saw it differently, because when asked, you know, if Karl Rove were to walk by here, would you stab him in the back? She said, I'm paraphrasing here, but no, I would stab him in the front.
Look. Cindy McCain and the McCain campaign, Fletcher and others, they needed somebody to blame. And they didn't want to blame Bush. It was hard to blame Bush. He's a nice guy. People knew him. It wouldn't stick. So why not pick out the sort of dough-faced, you know, balding guy who's the gray eminence behind the campaign and blame him? And look, that's the way politics is. Bush had a theory. He'd say, better you than me. And that's right. That came with the territory.
Oh, you miserable turd. Oh, what a piece of human waste. He gives himself away when he says, look, Cindy McCain and the McCain campaign, they needed somebody to blame, and they didn't want to blame Bush. It was hard to blame Bush. Well, then, Carl, you weaselly scumsucker, why not blame the person that you claim did it? The professor at Bob Jones University, Professor Hand. Oh my God! We'll have some more. We're gonna have some more sound on this piece of human waste tomorrow. I love that about Cindy McCain. No, I wouldn't stab him in the back. I'd stab him in the front. Then look into his eyes and grin while his life force drained into the sewer. Is there any creature in America lower than Karl Rove? There must be. I guess someone who murders a child would be lower than Karl Rove. But beyond child murder, I can't think of somebody who would be lower on the filth totem pole than Karl Rove. And now he's out there pounding his book. And, of course, this filthy, whorish media that we have, no offense to sex workers, are perfectly content to give this doughboy airtime. Amazing.
Have you seen the little piggies crawling in the dirt? And for all the little piggies, life is getting worse. Always having dirt to play around in. Have you seen the bigger piggies in the starched white shed? You will find the bigger piggies stirring up the dirt. Always have clean sheds to play around in.
Ah.
Redefining Anger Management. It's Mike Malloy.
What weapons, sharpened knives, makes you want to have the other half die? Other half die.
It's about 10 before the hour. Peter Werby's going to join us after the top of the hour. Joy in Sacramento writes, good morning. She wrote this morning. We, my partner and I, went to see Paula Poundstone in Sacramento Saturday night. Paula's show was a sellout, so there were 1,000, 1,500 people leaving the event at the same time. We walked across the street to the parking garage where our car was parked and stood in a line of, 40 or so people who were prepaying their parking at one of those little ticket machines. I live in a government town, Sacramento. Honest to effing God, Jesus help me. The woman standing in line behind me said because of the short line to pay parking at the ticket machine, well, typical, the closer to the heart of government we are, the worse it is. Because it's Sacramento. My partner looked at me and gave me the don't go there look. So what I said was, WTF does government have to do with a line of people paying their parking fee? What the woman was doing was throwing out one of those hooks for me to then say my Glenn Beck statement, and then we would bond in line, I guess. Mike, this freak was ready to blame Obama for the effing parking line. That's where she was going. 1,500 people exited the show at the same time. Of course there's going to be a line. Have I told you lately how much I hate these people, too? Joy in Sacramento. Oh, my God. The closer you get the seat of government. See? Yeah. You got to stand in line. They're insane, Joy. They're insane. And then there's this. This is from John in Pineville, West Virginia. Mr. Malloy, after listening to the replay of your show on Sunday night, he's talking about the Friday show, I thought as a resident of West Virginia that I should take this time to tell you that Rockefeller and most delegates from this state are and have been in the pockets of the coal companies for several years. As one prosecutor said, we are a coal country. We couldn't care less about farming, business, etc. What my emailer here is referring to is J. Rockefeller, the fourth senator from West Virginia, and most of the Democratic delegation from West Virginia, asking the EPA to hold off on its pollution guidelines, needs more study because West Virginia, we're working on clean coal. Anyway, back to what my emailer writes. Remember the coal wars, the Matawan massacre, and the Battle of Blair Mountain? Something that you can appreciate. Union and non-union workers versus the state and federal government, along with the people hired by the coal companies. I apologize for digressing from what my point is. The fact is, many people here are not intelligent. They're not stupid, but they are undereducated, they're poor, and many lack what many people take for granted. It is not like the money made from coal gets put back into the community, like road maintenance or education or environmental restoration. No, 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 no. As I've said many times, despite my own paycheck coming from coal, we need to move away from coal and its use. The human toll and the damage done to the environment is maddening. I see it on a daily basis. I talk to these miners whose bodies are falling apart. I watch the aftermath of the shooting crew. I'm not sure what that means. However, you must keep in mind that these coal companies are every bit as large and powerful as the largest of banks, insurance companies, and oil companies, and all they care about is profit. I want to thank you for what you are attempting to do. It falls on deaf ears, and that must be very frustrating. Sorry I'm digressing again, but it's hard to stay on topic while looking at the place that a mountain ridge once was. Now, in its place, a bench for a high-wall miner. I'm not sure what that is either. While I make minimum wage, wondering how I'm going to pay my medical bills from an ATV accident, college loans, and help my elderly parents, I also do not want to come across as a whiner or someone who's lost their mind. We have enough of that. But at this point, my cries have fallen on deaf ears, just like my coworkers and friends' cries have fallen on deaf ears. It is sad that at 28 years old, I have become so skeptical and distrusting of my government, which appears to be sold to the highest bidder. They are more worried about helping the business community. Well, as a person, I am owned by my employer, and my government seems to not care. We have the I think I haves who refuse to listen to what they're being told, what they're hearing, the hypocritical comments, the straw men, the fake rants. And they might very well hear it, but they don't listen to it. Be well, John in Pineville, West Virginia. Well, the government isn't responsible, I don't think, for what's going on. I really don't, John, in the sense that the government is a separate entity from corporatism. It is not any longer. Barack Obama is a nice man and a good speaker, and I'm sure his heart's in the right place, but there's nothing he can do. And I think we all pretty much know that. He may get this watered-down health insurance reform bill passed, but corporate America owns the country. Corporate America was a bit surprised at Obama's making it through the Democratic Party primaries. They, you know, of course, they got on Obama once it was clear that he had a chance. But Obama was not what they were looking for by any means. Corporate America was looking preferably for a white man and preferably for a Republican and preferably somebody like George W. Bush that they could easily manipulate, or at least the people they put around him could easily manipulate. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy. Matewan, West Virginia, not Matewan, as I pronounced it, thanks to the several people who made that correction. Peter Werbe is the dean of Detroit Radical Crazy Left-Wing Talk Show host. He joins us now. Hey, Peter.
Hey, Mike, my co-conspirator in thought crimes.
Yeah, I'm surprised you're not in Guantanamo or someplace. Well, you were in Cuba, weren't you?
I was in Cuba, and one time did go to Guantanamo City, which is about 30 kilometers from the base. But
well, I would think that the Rovian corporatists would have locked your ass up by now, frankly.
Well, you know, it was interesting when I came back.
And mine.
Absolutely. When I came back, I traveled through Canada to Havana. I flew from Toronto to Havana. Mm-hmm. And when I came back from Windsor, which is right across Detroit,
right.
I got this major hassle. I mean, they had me up against the wall, searching me, and were asking me every question under...
Because of the Cuba stamp in your passport?
Yeah, well, actually, they don't stamp your passports. I told them, because it's a felony to lie, and I told them I'm a journalist. I
right.
write about Cuba. I broadcast about Cuba.
Right.
So they said, did you register as a journalist when you went to Cuba? And I said, no, I didn't. And he said, why didn't you? I said, well, because I was afraid a bunch of armed men would take me into a room and ask me a bunch of questions and search me.
Oh, my God. These are Americans.
These are Americans. Yeah. The Cubans were fine, you know.
Yeah, and the Canadians really didn't give a damn, did
they?
No,
they don't care at all.
Yeah.
But I don't think there's any problem because, you know, that so far Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of the press, so they can't restrict journalists. And I think
that's true. But then why, it begs the question, why not fly from Detroit Metro?
Well, there are no flights. And the other reason was that
that makes sense. Yeah.
I went on, this time and last time when I went on tours that were organized from Toronto, that were people that were interested in seeing what was happening on the ground. I mean, we all know pretty much, you don't have to go to Cuba to know what's happening with the political situation in Cuba or what they're doing or what they're saying, but to see what kind of inventive and imaginative kind of stuff that they're doing on every level, from agriculture to film and art and what have you, is pretty interesting, and you don't get to see too much of that. But this tour is committed to doing that, and I mean, it's like two separate worlds. You know, it's you've got this bureaucratic edifice at the top, you know, Los Hermanos, the brothers, and then down, you know, in the trenches, you got a lot of people just trying to get by, like here, and a lot of people trying to do really radical stuff in the sense of new stuff, something that would change the world.
Well, you know, that's the thing about the Castro brothers. The idea of when most people think about democratic socialism, well, usually they just think about socialism, and democratic socialism, which to me is about the only way to go that makes any sense whatsoever. But the Cuban model is always tossed in our faces, and we're not talking about the kind of dictatorial. Now, I've not been to Cuba, Peter, so correct me if I'm wrong, but Los Hermanos, the dictatorial socialism, how does that work for the Cuban people?
Well, you know, for one thing, I was very aware, you know, things like in the 1930s when American communists would go to the Soviet Union and they'd say, oh, a workers' paradise,
right,
everyone's happy. And
which was simply not true.
Yeah, absolutely not. It was a horrid police state, a torture state that destroyed any semblance of a real alternative to capitalism.
Right.
But, you don't get to be an expert by going there for one week at a time and seeing, you know, one little bit of it. But it occurs to me that, that it's not what we generally have this model of. It's, for one thing, it's not a failed state.
Right.
In fact, for all its bureaucratic bungling, and hello, it's not like we live in a country that doesn't suffer from massive bureaucratic bungling, both governmental and corporatist, right?
No doubt.
But people say it's a poor country, and they split up the wealth fairly evenly, not completely evenly. There's some people doing a lot better than others, but in the main, they take care of people, and they don't have a big pot of gold like we have. I mean, this is why this is so obscene. Here, you got people rooting through trash cans for returnable bottles, 2 miles from where I live and where I'm talking to you right now in the Detroit suburb, and 2 miles north of me, you know, people are living this luxurious life of opulence. That doesn't happen in Cuba. And no one goes hungry. No one. I mean, I think most people, particularly people that listen to your show, Mike, know that there's good health care. There's food for everybody. They don't. It's not a narco-trafficante state. They don't involve themselves in terrorism. And at the top, if you mess with them, gee, it sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it? If you mess with them, they come down on you real hard. And I am completely and 100% critical of that, as I'm sure you are.
Speaking of health care, you know, we're on the cusp of something, either a baby step forward to single-payer health care or an absolute train wreck put together by, in fact, the insurance companies working inside the Obama administration. How does what we are dealing with compare with the Cuban model. Now, I'm aware that Cuba's medical universities, if I'm not mistaken, or university, turns out top flight doctors who then travel around the globe offering medical services to people who otherwise would never see a doctor.
Yeah, I think they have one of the highest ratios of doctors to population, maybe even in the world. And I know that there's a lot of very high-quality facilities. They do a lot of very, you know, high-tech operations and what have you. I don't know that if every one of the thousands and thousands of doctors that that graduate and that go to other countries and help other people and they got sent to Haiti and you know, help the poor people in Venezuela and return for oil and all that, are they like our top flight GPs? They may be, but they have enough skills to help people that in normal circumstances would get nothing, because that's what happens. I mean, I always contrast free democratic Mexico and totalitarian commie Cuba. Well, gee, I mean, it sort of throws the equations all up in the air, because particularly if you're a poor person.
Right.
I mean, the poor in Cuba live better than any poor in the world, including the United States.
I think it would be a mistake, would it not, to compare Cuban doctors to, if you remember during Mao's day in China, the so-called barefoot doctors who granted, probably practiced some traditional medicine, but they also, it's my understanding, had to practice medicine that was in keeping with the thoughts of Chairman Mao. So these Cuban doctors are different from the barefoot doctors in China, yes?
No, it's all Western medicine, and it's, you know, universal. You know, this will drive all the conservatives crazy, but it's universal single-payer health care.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're sick, you go there. And that's why they have such a low infant mortality rate, and one that is probably four times lower than that of inner-city Detroit. Again, 4 or 5 miles from me. It's like the infant mortality rate of a third world country, and there's a third world country like Cuba that has a first world infant mortality rate.
What we got to do a break here. Can you stick around a little bit?
Sure.
Okay, let me put you on hold, Peter, and we'll come back. We're talking with Peter Werbe. You can go to peterwerbe.com and get the schedule of his program. He's been on Detroit radio as a radical leftist talk show host for a number of years, and they still haven't silenced him, and I hope they never do. Peter Werbe. Go to peterwerbe.com. We'll be right back.
And as he left, he called out to me.
That's Peter, W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com.
Show. Talk radio matters here.
It's 21 past the hour. We're talking with Peter Werbe, who is in Detroit, even as we speak, who recently has returned from Cuba for not the first time, and who hosts the Peter Werbe Show in that city. Go to peterwerbe.com for all that information. Peter, what is the attitude right now of the Castro government? And I'm working on the assumption that Raul Castro really is in charge and not Fidel. What is the attitude of the Cuban government where it concerns Obama?
Well, actually, the person that has said the most recently about Obama is Fidel, who apparently his health is getting better and better. The president of Brazil just visited him and said he looked in excellent health. And actually, again, the conservatives will love this, Fidel's attitude sort of mirrored many of ours, that we were quite hopeful about the Obama administration, thought there would be a 180-degree turn from the, you know, from the criminal Bush regime. And instead, it's, you know, veered off a few degrees. Some of the degrees have been very important. So they've, you know, they've, just like we've been, just like I've heard your show, Mike, and just like on my show, is that we're, you know, we're becoming more and more critical of Obama's what he's done and what he hasn't done, and then the Cuban government has had that attitude as well.
I would love to go there, and I guess it'd have to be a roundabout way. I could probably get by on the journalist credentials, but I'm trying to figure out how to get Molly in.
But, well, that is. Well, like, my wife couldn't come. I mean, she, you know, she probably...
Right. Well, I could get Kathy in, too, because she,
yeah,
she does.
But,
maybe we could just say, well, we have no child care. But we recently, about a year ago, we went to Puerto Rico and we overflew Hispaniola in Cuba. Well, not overflew Cuba. I guess you can't do that, but close enough that we could see both of these islands. And, you know, from obviously you're not going to see much from 33,000 feet, but, it was interesting to notice once again how close Cuba is, and given the history between the United States and Cuba, it makes no sense to me. I was in high school when Batista was overthrown, and I can remember my world history teacher at the time actually being celebrating this overthrow, because you remember Castro identified himself as an agrarian reformer,
right?
And which he always was. It just so happened he was a communist agrarian reformer. But the corruption that he ended after it was clear that the Cuban people were just being driven into the mud by the U.S. Mafia, by the U.S. CIA, by Batista, by the U.S. military.
And by the corporations.
And by the corporations who had such a death grip on that island. But why is it, and this, you can take this as a rhetorical question or try to answer it, why have we spent 50 years doing this with Cuba when our relationship with China is 180 degrees opposite?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it asking it answers it. And, I mean, partly it's the tale of the Cuban Americans in Florida and New Jersey wagging the dog, which is both the political parties, to be sure. You know, one of the things, you know, at the end of Michael Moore's film, Capitalism, A Love Story, says the alternative to capitalism is, and he says, democracy. And and people say, oh, we have to bring democracy to Cuba. Well, I would say, let's start here. I mean, we don't like Cuba because this undemocratic elite rules their nation.
Mm-hmm.
Gee, I'm glad we don't live in a country.
Oh yeah,
like
thank
that,
God,
right?
Thank God for that.
But the democracy could mean that Cuba, rather than looking like our country, would look more like Jamaica.
Mm-hmm.
And that's essentially what it means. It's like Iraq. You know, what really happens is the penetration of foreign capital to do what they did prior to being chased out by this horrible repressive nationalist who was also our buddy at one time, Saddam Hussein, mm-hmm. or in this case, you know, Castro, who threw out the corporations and the mafia, and as you said, the U.S. intelligence, who ruled the country in tandem, the three of them. So, to allow, you know, let me put it this way: the idea that maybe a third of the country that despises the Castros, and which isn't as high as how many people are remembered to despise Bush, by any means,
right?
They dream of, you know, of being this consuming like their brethren in Miami. Well, it's not going to wind up like that. You know, like I say, it's going to wind up like Jamaica. Right now, there's very little crime in Cuba. There's crime, you know, more than they admit. But for a state under the gun, they don't do too badly. On the other hand, I, as you do, Mike, condemn any repressive action on the part of any government and make no apologies for it whatsoever.
Yeah, left or right. Hey, can you stick around another few minutes?
Sure.
All right, let me put you back on hold. We're talking with Peter Werbe a Detroit radio talk show host who has been around since God was a teenager. Go to his website, peterwerby.com. We'll be back. Stay with us.
America, one flying monkey at a time. It's More Mike Malloy.
It's about 25 before the hour. Peter Werby is the number one left talk show host, radio talk show host in Detroit, probably in the entire Midwest, and recently made another trip to Cuba. That's why we're talking to him tonight. PeterWerby.com is his website, W-E-R-B-E, PeterWerby.com. The relationship between Cuba and the rest of Latin America, Peter, now that so many governments have gone left of center, even though some of them are starting to look a little dodgy, but what about the relationship now with Cuba and the rest of the South Latin American countries?
Let me just say parenthetically, I have no objection whatsoever to being identified as a left talk show host, although given the nutballs that have come out of the woodwork lately that that are saying that the enemy of America is the progressivist movement, I like my program yesterday, I was saying, call me a progressive. But
wouldn't you love, seriously now, just between you and me, nobody's listening, wouldn't you love to just kick Glenn Beck's ass? I mean, I swear to God. But anyway.
I hate to see a grown man cry.
Yeah, I know.
But, of course, we do. We do get to see him cry. One of the things, let me again, parenthetically, the left, in many cases, has been entirely too uncritical of the Cuban government.
Yeah.
And the feeling is that if you're critical at all, you're playing into the hands of the imperialist.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that people that have a great desire for a democracy that's fair and equal has to level criticism at any dictatorial government, including ours and beginning with ours.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Oh, so actually, I'm trying to dodge your question of the relationship of Cuba to the rest of the nations south of us. Well, even north, I mean, because Canada has diplomatic relations with Cuba, and I think every country, even Colombia, I believe, our little patron, country there, our little vassal in South America, does. And I would think that after all these years, that they've gotten used to Cuba. And many of them, as we were talking about with the doctors' exchange with Venezuela and the way that they send doctors into Haiti immediately, that they. Since they no longer do the bidding directly of the United States, it just doesn't have the impact it did even 10, 15 years ago.
Do you think there are mitigating forces inside Cuban society that will bring about a more, literally a more democratic government once Los Hermanos are gone?
Well, those are the kind of questions actually that you or I could equally discover by reading, and that's something that one can travel around for a week. They talk about it being a communist police state, and I have to say, even in Havana, I saw very few police and very few communists. So that's the big question. I mean, what would happen? I mean, many of the East German dissidents, in fact, the majority of them wanted a democratic socialist nation. They wanted to get rid of the police apparatus. They wanted to get rid of the privilege of the bureaucrats. Mm-hmm. That was, you know, like they maybe lived like the governor of Georgia or the governor of Michigan, you know, not like the wealthy
right.
do in this country. And instead, they got, you know, full-blown market capitalism, which, you know, turned out to be disastrous for East Germany. But essentially what you're asking, is there organized the resistance inside of Cuba that wants not a return to the Batista
that wants democratic socialism rather than totalitarian socialism.
Yeah, I think there's lots of them, but I don't think that they're, from everything that I've been able to ferret out, I don't think there's any real organization. A lot of it is very brave individuals that, like in China, that just wind up, spending 20 years in jail.
Mm-hmm.
And as a 40-year union member, the idea that if you try to organize an independent union in Cuba, you'll wind up in jail, again, is pretty distasteful. And, of course, what the government of Cuba says, we're under constant attack by this enormous imperial power that dominated our economy and our political life for 50 years and now has distorted our economy to an embargo for 50 years. And mm-hmm. if we let some of these Cubans, some of who, like, 2 and 3 years ago were coming down to the American interest section on the Melicon in Havana and going, Viva Bush. Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking, they need some PR work, you know?
Yeah, yeah, right.
This is not the way to go about it.
Right.
But I don't think that there's nothing like that anybody has seen that mass resistance. I mean, I would say that from everything I've read and from what I've talked to people while in Cuba twice, there's grumbling. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, there's not enough transportation. You know, if you're in Cambodia, if you're in Uganda, you take it for granted that you're in 24 people in a VW minibus, or that 40 people, I counted one time, sitting in and on top of a pickup truck. The Cubans expect that they should have a level, the poorest people think that they should have a level of convenience and consumption worthy of a socialist state. So mm-hmm. when they've got to wait like an hour and a half for a bus, and then the bus comes and it's crowded, it's a crappy old bus, they're pissed off.
Mm-hmm. Is Cuba the classic American car paradise that it seems to be?
Yeah, you know, there are lots, particularly in Havana. The other time I was in the far eastern districts where, like, Guantanamo City is and all that. But, yeah, I mean, I should put some stuff up on my website, which I haven't gotten around to. But, yeah, there's your 58 Chevys, and some of them, you know, and Cadillacs and mm-hmm. DeSotos and Dodges. Wait, but what's the ones that we don't Nashes and Hudsons and
mm-hmm.
Frasers.
Studebakers?
Studebaker. Everything before, you know, 1958, and they're very inventive. You could see a beautiful, like, 58 Cadillac convertible, and it could have a Soviet tractor engine in it.
Oh, wow. You know, the one thing to me that stands out as to a very serious thing, a part of the Cuban culture the American people have been denied for 50 years is Cuban music, Cuban literature, Cuban poetry. And the people who produce it, to come to this country to perform. How many Cuban performers have attempted to come here and at the last moment had a visa denied or told not to even bother to begin with? But Cuban music is different, is it not, from all other sorts of Caribbean or Latin American music?
Well, I don't want to really, because I'm not an expert on that, but it has that musical culture, that rhythmic sense permeates every minute of life. And there'll be like six men playing bongos and congas and guitars on a street corner, and all of a sudden 30 kids will come up from a school, Cuban kids, and they'll start singing those songs along mm-hmm. with the elderly men. They all know those songs. They're all just so linked in together. And you got to keep telling yourself, yeah, look at, there's this really tough repressive government at the top, because people don't act like that. They appear you know, grumbling about this, grumbling about that, and that's not unusual. I mean, we do a bit of grumbling here with good justification, as in mostly they do as well. But they seem to have such a high appreciation and structure, an appreciation of their culture and a structure of life that that made me feel like, you know, we're really missing a lot here.
And that structure, you think, kind of transcends whatever political BS they have to deal with.
Yeah. I mean, indeed. You just see that. I mean, they seem, I mean, you know, this, I don't mean to make them into these exotic, people. But, you know, they seem to express emotion so much more than the waspy way, you know, so frequently we do in this country.
After 50 years of embargoes by the United States, and the fact that since it is a totalitarian socialist state, I'm sure it's difficult for people in that country to get international passports. How ingrown, if at all, have the Cuban people become?
Well, it's an interesting question. I hadn't thought about that. I mean, if you think about it, you know what percentage of people in this country have passports? I think it's like 25%. I mean, you know, if you think about that, people in Kansas and Missouri and all that, I mean, the main reason at first that I ever had a passport is because, you know, I live 8 miles from
Canada. Yeah, but we're such a homogeneous or a heterogeneous society. We're vast. I mean, the difference in Miami and Seattle is the difference in Moscow and Caracas.
Again, well, it's a poor country. I don't think that there's too many people that would have the opportunity to travel as it is. The airfare, I was fortunate. The airfare, initially I didn't go because the airfare from Toronto to Havana was $875.
Hey, hold on. Is that round trip?
Yeah.
Hold on a sec. Can you just do about four more minutes?
Sure.
Okay.
Loving it.
All right. We'll talk with, we'll continue the conversation with Detroit radio talk show host Peter Werbe when we come back. Go to his website, peterwerbe.com. Before the hour, we're talking with Peter Werbe from Detroit, who recently came back from another trip to Cuba. I had a question in mind, Peter, and it has gotten away.
Hey, let me just tell you a couple things I saw.
That's a good idea.
One was went to John Lennon Park. And there's a life-size statue of the Beatle, John Lennon, sitting on a park bench.
Really?
Yeah, and in Spanish, it has the words from Imagine, you say that I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. And the Cubans, the Castro, infamously banned the Beatles in 1964, said they were bourgeois degenerate, bad examples for youth, which is probably why we liked them so much.
Yeah, really.
Time.
Yeah.
But by 2000, he had completely turned around and went to the dedication of this. And on my website at Peter Werbe, and thank you for spelling it because no one ever gets it, W-E-R-B-E, there's a picture of me with John Lennon.
Sitting on a bench.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. In Havana.
Strikingly, there is a memorial to Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, who were were executed and convicted for spying for the Soviet Union in one of the most outrageously and infamously trials imaginable in U.S. history. so there's these odd little aspects to this country that make it so charming. I just
What did the Cuban people? How did the people you came in touch with? How did they relate to you? You're an American. I'm sure it didn't take long once they engage you in conversation to realize you are not a Bush American. But how did they relate to you as an American?
Well, they were thrilled, actually, that I was there and that I seemed interested. And our guides, who were translators and guides, I mean, one of them said, I'm going to show you the good, the bad, and the ugly on our tour. And we went to different facilities and different projects. Agriculture, you know, they have all this organic gardening inside of the city. I mean, a massive, you know, acres and acres and acres of organic produce that now when they got cut off from the Soviet Union, they just started growing it without chemicals, growing their stuff. And then the other one, our other guide said something that, he said, I don't want you to, I can't remember the one word, but she said, and neither to make us, you know, more than we are, nor to demonize us.
Right.
And I think that's critical. I think that's critical for us as Americans, certainly not to get swept up in the hysteria that about Cuba that's been going on for the last 50 years, because in a sense, it's a mirror. Everything that the United States has ever said about Cuba could be said probably triple about this country.
Yeah, I was just going to say, we have, setting aside the horrors of our torture gulags, including Gitmo, we have political prisoners in this country. To what extent are there political prisoners in Cuba?
Well, Amnesty International, and I have to take them at their word because I have great respect for them, says there's, I think, 235 political prisoners in Cuba, which is absolutely 235 too many.
Sure.
I mean, and when that dissident just died in a Cuban jail, which is absolutely disgraceful and to be condemned, Raul Castro said, how can the United States criticize us when in Guantanamo Bay?
Right.
You know, like that. So, I mean, that doesn't excuse it. And, you know, we knew from kindergarten, two wrongs don't make a right.
Right. Well, it also says something in the Bible about removing the beam from your own eye before you talk about the mote in someone else's.
Sure. So it's a diversion, mainly. And the people in Cuba never seem to me, even this Republican poll that I don't know how the hell they took it there, the main thing that the Cuban people are interested in is, again, just like our country, and what do you think, in an economy that allows them to have security and have the things that they want? Do they want to have more decision making? I suspect so. We'd like it, right?
Yeah, that'd be a unique. You know, someday democracy is going to come to this country. One last question here. We got about a minute, Peter. Does the Cuban government? Do you see the Cuban government kind of going to a mixed economy for the dollars that are involved?
Well, there's not U.S. dollars at all. They really got rid of that. They're mostly operating off the Canadian dollar and
The tourist industry.
The euro, yeah, yeah. And for those that love capitalism, I would say that there's more and more capitalistic stuff going on all the time. And that's not what Che envisioned, what he said, socialist man encompassing, you know, humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's beginning to fray. So those among us that just dream about Cuba's experiment failing, well, I don't have the greatest hopes in the world, although every once in a while I see things there among the people that are so admirable that I hope that the good parts of it remain.
Well, I hope you get some photos and some stuff up on your website, because I'll go, and I'm sure a lot of people listening to you tonight would like to go, since Cuba is this place on the map where it says, do not go here. Here be demons.
That makes you want to go, doesn't it?
It makes you want to go. Peter, thanks. Good talking to you again.
Mike, you are the best. Thank you so much. And hello to all my friends out there on your show as well.
Hey, we'll talk again soon.
Thanks.
All right.
Bye.
Take care. Peter Werbe in Detroit, Michigan. Go to his website if you're so inclined. Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. And check out what he's got to say. We shall return after the break. Stick around. We have miles to go before we sleep. I'm Mike Malloy. Seven past the hour. At the bottom of this hour, we're going to have our Uncle Mike Story Corner. It's very scary. Seriously. From Politics Daily. Oh, no, wait a minute. Not this one. Yeah, politicsdaily.com. Pope Benedict the 16th was in Uganda over the weekend, last Friday, meeting with the Roman Catholic hierarchy there. And he delivered a speech, according to Politics Daily, summing up what he saw as the main tasks of the church in Uganda. But he made no mention of this anti-homosexuality bill that has rightly so caused an international outcry. That's the legislation in the pending in the Ugandan parliament that provides for execution of homosexuals, and if not execution, life imprisonment, hence the nickname, the Kill the Gays Bill. And for jail terms for those who know somebody's homosexual and doesn't report them to the authorities. American conservative Christians, some of them, have been seen as giving aid and comfort to Ugandan politicians and Christians who want to do this. You know, this is... this is something that other Christians in America say, look, we don't want any part of this. But the fact is, evangelizing or, evangelical Christians have led this effort. Now, why do we talk about gay issues? Somebody sent me an email. Why are you always talking about gay stuff? It's a very simple reason as far as I'm concerned, and that is to a certain extent, gays in America in this time are like Jews in Germany in the 30s, aren't they? The right wing in this country that is chock-a-block with gay folk who choose to remain closeted, but the right wing in this country has gone so far into insane territory where it concerns gay people. Denying them the right to get married as though they were outside the family of humankind. All the restrictive laws where it concerns homosexuals, and how easy a target gay folk are for right wingers, especially ones who use the Bible as a goddamn bludgeon on people. It concerns me because, you know, again, going back to a Christian theologian statement, Pastor Niemöller in Germany in the 20s and 30s, who said, you know what he said, but you can update it and say, you know, first they came for the gays and I didn't say anything because I wasn't gay, and so on and so on and so on and so on. But this Pope Benedict the 16th, with this massive scandal of prostitution going on inside his own inner circle, you would think, wouldn't you? At least I think, that the Pope would consider the position of the Church, the Catholic Church, the Roman Church, where it concerns gay folk, and come to a startling and obvious conclusion that it is insanity to keep this up. To continue to act as though gay people are different from non-gay people. I mean, we're not, any more than black folk are different from Asians, or Latinos are different from Anglos. I mean, come on, Jesus H. Christ. You would think that the Church would provide some leadership, right? In his address to the bishops of Uganda last Friday, Benedict made no reference to the anti-gay bill or the international outcry about it. Instead, he called on the Ugandan bishops to, quote, encourage the Catholics of Uganda to appreciate fully the sacrament of marriage in its unity and indissolubility and the sacred right to life. The latter, of course, is a reference to abortion. The Nazi Pope also urged the Ugandan bishops to, quote, resist the seduction of a materialistic culture of individualism, which has taken root in so many countries, end quote. Materialistic culture. Again, is the irony not so obvious that even the head of the Roman Church, one of the most wealthy institutions in the history of humankind, can't see it? It's astonishing. Well, now, I just got this. It's from Der Spiegel, German newspaper, the English edition, from today, Monday. Ratzinger, the Nazi Pope, his brother, George, has been connected to this Regensburger Domspatzen, which is boarding schools attached to the famous Catholic choir, or choir boys who are part of this Catholic choir. It says it's inexplicable that the Pope's brother, George Ratzinger, doesn't know about this abuse scandal that is exploding in Germany. The choir boys talk about naked beatings. Therapists in and around Munich are treating former choir boys who were traumatized by sexual and physical abuse. One man affected told Der Spiegel about cruel rituals in the Ettershausen boarding school, the preparatory school for younger pupils, from which this choir draws its recruits. He said, back in the day, the headmaster of the school, a Catholic priest, had dealt out hard physical punishments. He had often practiced what was called naked beatings in his private rooms, where boys aged 8 or 9 had to undress and were beaten by hand. And in some cases, the victims said, penetration, use your imagination on that one, took place. The director and composer, Franz Wittenbrink, who lived in one of these boarding schools for the choir until the late 60s, said the school had, quote, an elaborate system of sadistic punishments combined with sexual lust. Oh, my God, end quote. And the article goes on. It's I don't know if it's hard for me to say this. It's almost ironic for me to say this, but there's some stuff in here that's in Der Spiegel, English edition, that was sent to me that I would have difficulty talking about on this program. But with all of this going on, the Catholic Church USA still finds it to its advantage in maintaining its power to provide not just the support of volunteers and publicity and so on and so forth, but also money support to fund or work behind these various, what are they called, Kathy? The initiatives, ballot initiatives, to continue to deny gay folk just the most elemental of rights, and that is the right to be married, to form a contract with the person you want to be married to, and with all the rights and responsibilities that go with that. But the Catholic Church, I mean, this is like something out of some medieval torture story or something. I just don't get this. Maybe it's because Ratzinger was a Nazi. Maybe that was it. You think that was it?
Ammunition against right-wing rhetoric, get locked and loaded with Mike Malloy.
Everyone past the hour. I don't know. I have a hard time understanding the the bigotry that is directed against homosexuals. I really do. It makes no sense to me. I've tried to figure out. Okay, where does that come from? And other than a couple of glancing admonitions that are interpreted to be anti-homosexual in the Old Testament of the so-called Christian Bible, I guess it really belongs to the Jews, at least that part of it. I can't find anything that makes logical sense. Even getting into cultural anthropology, if you check back over history, you find that homosexual liaisons were honored, were seen as even more sanctified in certain cultures, in certain advanced cultures, than heterosexual relationships. So. Not that either one is, as far as I'm concerned, is any different from the other. It is people caring enough about each other to get together, to form a union, for partners, lovers, married people if they can, people that dedicate their lives to each other on whatever level it's possible to dedicate your life to somebody else. A lot of people say, well, that's impossible. You can't do that. You got to live your own life. Okay, fine. Live your own life. But you understand what I mean. I just don't get this. I can understand where racial bigotry comes from. I can understand where nationalism comes from. I can understand how religious bigotry is rampant on Earth, because it seems to me that all of those bigotries come from some sort of, my gang is better than your gang, and we will beat your ass to make the point. But a person's sexuality, it cuts across, within a society, it cuts across all demographic groups, all income groups, whether you are making your money on Wall Street or making your money from collecting cows, back in the 4,000 years ago, it doesn't matter. So many of the patriarchs in the Bible appear to have been gay. I mean, look at David, look at Solomon, please. So where does this come from? And once it takes root, anti-gay bigotry is murderous. It is like racial bigotry. There are and religious bigotry. It is so simple for certain minds to murder, to beat, to attempt to harm people whose only offense to these other folks is the fact of their sexuality. I can't get my mind around that. I just can't. If I'm a Muslim and you're a Christian and we are fighting over Jerusalem 1,000 years ago, okay, I get it. But if I'm a homosexual and you're a heterosexual, what the hell have we got to fight about? I mean, what do we got to fight about? Odds are we're in the same family, the same blood family. I mean, come on. So I've not been able to get my mind around. That's the reason we talk about this issue so much on this program. Or it seems like a lot to me anyway. I've not been able to get my mind around where this comes from and how sick it really is. Homophobia, how utterly and absolutely mind-bogglingly idiotic to be bigoted again to the extent that you are willing to write laws, you're willing to amend your goddamn constitution to stop people of the same gender from getting married? What? I mean, we didn't even try to do that, did we, about any other group? I mean, not that the right-wingers in this country wouldn't like to. You know, I'm sure they would like to put together a constitutional amendment that says if you're not Christian, you're a second-class citizen. But I mean, this is an active effort. The ballot initiatives, the legislative initiatives to deny people a right to get married. Son of a bitch, that is sick. I mean, it is sick. It is stupid. It is ignorant. And it can be murderous. That's why.
Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up.
Conservatives, don't be afraid. Be very afraid. It's Mike Malloy.
It's about 25 before the hour. I think it's time for Uncle Mike's Story Corner. Spring is just around the corner. So we thought we would provide you with a very scary story that has nothing whatsoever to do with spring or daylight savings time. The title of tonight's Uncle Mike Story Corner, Calling All Rebels. And the author is Chris Hedges. There are no constraints left to hold America's slide into a totalitarian capitalism. Electoral politics are a sham. The media have been debased and defanged by corporate owners. The working class has been impoverished and is now being plunged into profound despair. The legal system has been corrupted to serve corporate interests. Popular institutions, from labor unions to political parties, have been destroyed or emasculated by corporate power. And any form of protest, no matter how tepid, is blocked by an internal security apparatus that is starting to rival that of the East German secret police. The mounting anger and hatred coursing through the bloodstream of the body politic make violence and counterviolence inevitable. Brace yourself. The American empire is over, and the descent is going to be horrifying. Those singled out as internal enemies will include people of color, immigrants, gays, intellectuals, feminists, Jews, Muslims, union leaders, and those defined as liberals. They will be condemned as anti-American and blamed for a decline. The economic collapse, which remains mysterious and enigmatic to most Americans, will be pinned by demagogues and hate mongers on these hapless scapegoats. And the random acts of violence, which are already leaping up around the fringes of American society, will justify harsh measures of internal control that will snuff out the final vestiges of our democracy. The corporate forces that destroyed the country will use the information systems they control to mask their culpability. The old game of blaming the weak and the marginal, a staple of despotic regimes, will empower the dark undercurrents of sadism and violence within American society and deflect attention from the corporate vampires that have drained the blood of the country. David K. Johnson told me, quote, "We're going to be poorer," end quote. Johnson was the tax reporter for the New York Times for 13 years and has written on how the corporate state rigged the system against us. He's the author of Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill, a book about hidden subsidies, rigged markets, and corporate socialism. He says, quote, "Health care is going to eat up more and more of our income. We are going to have less and less for other things. We're going to have some huge disasters sooner or later caused by our failure to invest. Dams and bridges will break. Buildings will collapse. There are water mains that are 25 to 50 feet wide. There will be huge infrastructure disasters. Our intellectual resources are in decline. We're failing to educate young people and instill them with vigor. We are going to continue to pour money into the military. I think it is impossible. I think it is possible. I do not say it is probable, but I think it's possible we'll have a revolution, a civil war that will see the end of the United States of America." End quote, David K. Johnson. Johnson went on, quote, "If we see the end of this country, it will come from the right and our failure to provide people with the basic necessities of life. Revolutions occur when young men see the present as worse than the unknown future. We are not there, but it will not take a lot to get there. The politicians running for office who are denigrating the government, who are saying there are traitors in Congress, who say we do not need the IRS, this when no government in the history of the world has existed without a tax enforcement agency, they are sowing the seeds for the destruction of this country. A lot of the people on the right hate the United States of America. They would say they hate the people they are arrayed against. But the whole idea of the United States is that we criticize the government. We remake it to serve our interests. They do not want that kind of society. They reject, as Aristotle said, the idea that democracy is to rule and to be ruled in turns. They see a world where they are right, and that is it. If we do not want to do it their way, we should be vanquished. This is not the idea on which the United States was founded," end quote, David K. Johnson. It's hard to see how this can be prevented. The engines of social reform are dead. Liberal apologists, who long ago should have abandoned the Democratic Party, continue to make pathetic appeals to a tone-deaf corporate state and Barack Obama, while the working and middle class are ruthlessly stripped of rights, incomes, and jobs. Liberals self-righteously condemn imperial wars and the looting of the U.S. Treasury by Wall Street, but not the Democrats, who are responsible. And the longer the liberal class dithers and speaks in the bloodless language of policies and programs, the more hated and irrelevant it becomes. No one has discredited American liberalism more than liberals themselves, and I do not hold out any hope for their reform. We have entered an age in which, as William Butler Yeats wrote, quote, the best lack all conviction, and the worst are full of passionate intensity, end quote. David K. Johnson added, quote, if we end up with violence in the streets on a large scale, not random riots, but insurrection, and things break down, there will be a coup d'etat from the right. We have already had an economic coup d'etat. It will not take much to go further, end quote. How do we resist? How, if this descent is inevitable, as I believe it is, do we fight back? Why should we resist at all? Why not give in to cynicism and despair? Why not carve out as comfortable a niche as possible within the embrace of the corporate state and spend our lives attempting to satiate our private needs? The power elite, including most of those who graduate from our top universities and our liberal and intellectual classes, have sold out for personal comfort. Why not us? The French moral philosopher Albert Camus argued that we are separated from each other. Our lives are meaningless. We cannot influence fate. We all will die. And our individual being will be obliterated. And yet, Camus wrote that, quote, one of the only coherent philosophical positions is revolt. It is a constant confrontation between man and his obscurity. It is not aspiration, for it is devoid of hope. That revolt is the certainty of a crushing fate without the resignation that ought to accompany it. Camus warned, a living man can be enslaved and reduced to the historic condition of an object, but if he dies in refusing to be enslaved, he reaffirms the existence of another kind of human nature which refuses to be classified as an object, end quote. The rebel, for Camus, stands with the oppressed, the unemployed workers being thrust into impoverishment and misery by the corporate state, the Palestinians in Gaza, the civilians in Iraq and Afghanistan, the disappeared who are held in our global black sites, the poor in our inner cities and depressed rural communities, immigrants and those locked away in our prison system. And to stand with them does not mean a collaboration with parties, such as the Democrats, who can mouth the words of justice while carrying out acts of oppression. It means open and direct defiance. The power structure and its liberal apologists dismiss the rebel as impractical and see the rebel's outsider stance as counterproductive. They condemn the rebel for expressing anger at injustice. The elites and their apologists call for calm and patience. They use the hypocritical language of spirituality, compromise, generosity, and compassion to argue that the only alternative is to accept and work with the systems of power. The rebel, however, is beholden to a moral commitment that makes it impossible to stand with the power elite. The rebel refuses to be bought off with foundation grants, invitations to the White House, television appearances, book contracts, academic appointments, or empty rhetoric. The rebel is not concerned with self-promotion or public opinion. The rebel knows that, as Augustine wrote, hope has two beautiful daughters, anger and courage. Anger at the way things are and the courage to see that they do not remain the way they are. The rebel is aware that virtue is not rewarded. The act of rebellion defines itself. Vaclav Havel said when he battled the communist regime in Czechoslovakia, quote, you do not become a dissident just because you decide one day to take up this most unusual career. You are thrown into it by your personal sense of responsibility, combined with a complex set of external circumstances. You are cast out of the existing structures and placed in a position of conflict with them. It begins as an attempt to do your work well and ends with being branded an enemy of society. The dissident does not operate in the realm of genuine power at all. He's not seeking power. He has no desire for office and does not gather votes. He does not attempt to charm the public. He offers nothing and promises nothing. He can offer, if anything, only his own skin, and he offers it solely because he has no other way of affirming the truth he stands for. His actions simply articulate his dignity as a citizen, regardless of the cost, end quote. Those in power have disarmed the liberal class. They do not argue that the current system is just or good because they cannot. But they have convinced liberals that there is no alternative. All right, we have a break here, and then there's a little bit more in Uncle Mike's Story Corner tonight. Uncle Mike's Story Corner is rather lengthy tonight, but that's because it is so scary. For the hour, continuing Uncle Mike's Story Corner. Tonight, written by Chris Hedges, entitled Calling All Rebels. Those in power have disarmed the liberal class. They do not argue that the current system is just or good because they cannot. But they have convinced liberals that there is no alternative. But we are not slaves. We have a choice. We can refuse to be either a victim or an executioner. We have the moral capacity to say no, to refuse to cooperate. Any boycott or demonstration, any occupation or sit-in, any strike, any act of obstruction or sabotage, any refusal to pay taxes, any fast, any popular movement, and any act of civil disobedience ignites the soul of the rebel and exposes the dead hand of authority. Camus wrote, quote, "There is beauty, and there are the humiliated. Whatever difficulties the enterprise may present, I should like never to be unfaithful either to the second or the first." End quote. Mario Savio said in 1964, quote, "There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels, upon the levers, upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all." End quote. The capacity to exercise moral autonomy, the capacity to refuse to cooperate, offers us the only route left to personal freedom and a life with meaning. Rebellion is its own justification. Those of us who come out of the religious left have no quarrel with Camus. Camus is right about the absurdity of existence. He's right about finding worth in the act of rebellion rather than some bizarre dream of an afterlife or Sunday school fantasy that God rewards the just and the good. The ancient Greek poet Pindar wrote, quote, "O my soul, do not aspire to immortal life, but exhaust the limits of the possible." We differ with Camus only in that we have faith that rebellion is not ultimately meaningless. Rebellion allows us to be free and independent human beings, but rebellion also chips away, however imperceptibly, at the edifice of the oppressor and sustains the dim flames of hope and love. And in moments of profound human despair, these flames are never insignificant. They keep alive the capacity to be human. We must become, as Camus said, so absolutely free that existence is an act of rebellion. Those who do not rebel in our age of totalitarian capitalism and who convince themselves that there is no alternative to collaboration are complicit in their own enslavement. They commit spiritual and moral suicide. Another gem from Uncle Mike's Story Corner, brought to you by your friends at Offshore Drilling. Tonight, Calling All Rebels, written and posted by Chris Hedges. You can find this at truthdig.com if you would like your own copy. truthdig.com. Calling All Rebels by Chris Hedges. It is scary, isn't it? I think it's scary. I wasn't born to be a rebel, were you? I was born into the American dream at a certain time in this country when the American dream was coherent, focused, straightforward, and completely devoid of anything that was real. But we didn't know that. We really didn't. We believed in the American dream. And how could we not? Everything, every institution that that we found ourselves in from the moment we were born inculcated that belief in the specialness of being an American. Not only was God on our side, but whatever forces of the universe that God had unleashed were also on our side. Everything was on our side. We couldn't be defeated, not by anything, by anybody, by any ideology, any thought process, nothing. And I bought into that for the longest time. I really did. Maybe up until the time I was about 15. I really did believe that mythology. But I guess around age 15 or 16, somewhere around there, like most people, you know, one reaches that age of, wait a second. whoa, wait a minute. And of course, in the mid to late 50s, there were an awful lot of books and treasonous kinds of tracts and materials and essays being written, lots of them, that were designed to take young Americans completely off the path. Well, these are strange times, and while this is not what I ever thought I would get involved in, this kind of thinking is what I'm talking about. It's about the only kind of thinking, this idea of rebellion, that still makes any sense. This idea of saying no. Remember, rebellion can be extremely passive. As a matter of fact, some of the most effective rebellion in the history of the human race has been passive. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.
Are you burdened with